Well, here we are again, the same old shape we're in. Are we in love again, or have we always been? I'm your host, Scott C. Welcome to the SAFTAcast, the only podcast that talks to writers about everything except writing. Episode 45 is here for you today and now, or tonight if you're listening to this after the sun has set. We have a humdinger for you. I don't even know what a humdinger is, but I love the word, and I think it's supposed to be a positive word, isn't it? Indeed. Well, I think it's an accurate description of today's program, but I'll get to that in just a moment. Here it is, our first episode of 2016. The holiday season is well past us now. We got our holiday episode out of the way. We are on to it, and we have a slate of shows ready to go for this spring with some great interviews, some great people to talk to, and I know you're going to really enjoy it. Something else that's happening this spring, time for a little news from the Sundress Academy for the Arts, is the Outspoken Movement. It's something that I've talked about here on the program before, and I'm going to talk about it again right now. Outspoken, if you have never heard about it before with me, let me tell you a little bit about it. It is the third year running now at the Sundress Academy for the Arts. It is a program put on by SAFTA that takes place in June 2016, our third year. It is a chance to create a platform for LGBTQIA+ community of Knoxville, Tennessee and the surrounding areas to discuss, record, and perform the experiences of sex and gender diverse individuals in the South. You can be a part of this. SAFTA's Outspoken first workshop of the spring. They're doing three workshops on this live at the Sundress Academy for the Arts home base in Knoxville, Tennessee. And the first workshop of these three drops this Saturday, as I said, in Knoxville, Tennessee, the 23rd of January from 1 to 4 p.m. For information on tickets, here's how you can get it. You can go to sundresspublications.com and look for the link in the store at the top of the page, or you can go to www.sundressacademyfortheartsalloneword.com and click on Outspoken. There you can find all the details about it, how to submit your work, how to be considered for possible inclusion in this project this year in 2016, how to show your support for it if you are unable to be in the Knoxville area, and much, much more, as well as contact information. As I said, much more. We'll throw a link up on the SAFTAcast Facebook page as well. Yes, you know, we talk about resolutions and everything. The SAFTAcast has them as well. And one of our resolutions for 2016 is to get even more proactive about our social media presence. Facebook, Twitter, where you can find us at SAFTAcast. I'm told that maybe throwing a bunch of memes up will work. You know, something with minions. They seem to be very popular on social media. And they you know, if something's very popular, then it must generate more popularity, right? So we'll start working on those minion memes, I guess, or whatever the things that the kids like today. I don't know. Anyway, I'm rambling now. Let's get on to today's episode. Episode 45 is here with the one, the only, Sam Slaughter is with us, and it is a rollicking little interview as we talk about a diverse number of topics, including how long does it take for a person to die from strangulation, why Sam didn't go to Thailand when he had the opportunity, why he did go to Montana, as well as how to be nice, some tips for being nice to waitstaff and being nice to bartenders, and much, much more. Check out Sam on the internet at www.samslaughterthewriter.com, or you can find him on Twitter at @slaughterwrites. Check him out in his social media presence. You can also find him on Facebook. And check out his website to learn more about him. But websites can only take you so far. Sometimes it takes an interview to get to know someone, and that is what you are in for. A nice hour or so with Sam Slaughter here on the SAFTAcast coming at you right after the theme song. Man,
it's going.
Anyway, Sam, welcome to the program, man. It's great to have you on here finally.
Thanks. It's great to be on here.
Yeah, we've wanted you on for a while. Erin recommended. She's like, you got to get Sam on.
I really now hope that I live up to everything that she may or may not have said.
I'm sure you will, man. So
if I don't, just drink and it might get better.
Yeah, that's the solution for everything.
Mm-hmm.
Indeed. So I'd like to start off our show with the burning question that is on everyone's mind right now. Money is no object. Where is your dream vacation?
Oh, man. I was listening to a podcast this morning on the drive up here, and they were talking about Iceland, and Iceland sounded really cool, not just in the, you know, temperature sense, but there's really cool food there, apparently, like something about puffin or fermented shark sandwiches. I hear there are spas and like hot springs there. Vikings probably still exist. I don't know. Well, I'll go with Iceland.
Definitely a cool place to visit. Were they talking about the rotted fish in the ground?
I don't know. All they referred to it as a fermented shark sandwich. Grilled puffin was the other delicacy they were talking about.
I have heard of grilled puffin before.
I would like to try both of them.
Are you much of a foodie?
Yes. I will put anything into my mouth at least once.
What are some of the more unusual things that you've put into your mouth, food-wise?
thank you for clarifying that. A lot of it has been with the people at SAFTA. Let's see, we did the lamb slaughter back in September, and so lamb, brain, eye, tongue, cheek, neck, blood all happened in the same day. That was awesome. I used to live out in Montana, so I went to where they hold the Testy Festy, which is the testicle festival. And so I had Rocky Mountain oysters. Duck tongues was another one. Jellyfish was one. Muskrat also, again, with the people from SAFTA, and muskrat brain right out of the skull. Those are probably the top of the weirdest things that I've had.
That's a pretty impressive list, I gotta be honest.
I'm not stopping anytime soon, so.
Are there ones that you would go back on and be like, yeah, I'd definitely do that again?
I didn't mind the muskrat. Any of the lamb was all very good, or all of the lamb was all very good. I wouldn't do the duck tongues again, because they just had the consistency of like chicken fat, so it was just like chewing a lot of chicken fat, but with a bone inside almost. So that one wasn't too good, but most of them I'd try again, I think.
Is this a recent thing in your life, or have you always been a little bit adventurous when it comes to food?
I've always eaten whatever I can get my hands on. My mom was always very open to letting me try new things. My dad doesn't eat a whole lot of strange, weird, or even somewhat abnormal things, but my mom will try things, and so I would try things. We would go to restaurants that we'd never been to, that I had Indian food because of my mom for the first time, and sushi and all these other things because she would be okay with trying something new.
Does that adventurous spirit in you carry over beyond food? Is it like also in traveling and just your daily life?
I try. I don't want to say no to an opportunity to do something or try something unless there's a distinct possibility that I will die from it, but I'm still here, so I've made the right choices so far. With travel, I'll go wherever. I like seeing new places and experiencing new things. I was an anthropology major in college and for part of grad school, so the cultural aspect has always been interesting to me.
So, yeah, I know that you have an adventurous palate when it comes to the alcohol.
You could say that, yes.
I'll get to that, I'm sure, in a little bit. You start off in anthropology, but you fall into English eventually.
I was a double major, and it just happened that way. I did a year of grad school in anthropology out in Montana, and I went right after I graduated from college, so I was burnt out, and then moved back home to New Jersey, where I worked as a writer, and things fell into place from there, and that's why I'm here where I am now writing.
What do you mean, things fell into place?
I worked for a year as a newspaper reporter, won an award for that, moved up to New Hampshire, where I taught fourth grade for City Year, which is an AmeriCorps program. From there, I used my City Year scholarship to head down to Florida, where I got my master's at Stetson in English. And then I spent another year down there working with a brewery, working as a copywriter, and now I'm up here in South Carolina for my MFA. So it was just following a series of steps and going, I haven't been there before, let's try it.
Hey, worked for me. I often tell people I got my PhD because I was bored one day.
I can understand that.
Eating an ice cream sandwich, watching a movie, and I just said, you know, I've never been a doctor before. I think I'll do that.
It's on the list of goals for me because the name Dr. Slaughter would be pretty cool.
Well, you do have that unique name that you've, from what I've seen, you've almost kind of branded it in a way.
Yes, personal branding was, or branding itself. I was working as a copywriter in the marketing department for a company, so branding was big, and I decided, why not? I use the hashtag GetSlaughtered when I post my booze-related stuff.
What's the best variant that you've heard of that name? Like, I'm sure you've gotten Sergeant Slaughter jokes before.
Sergeant Slaughter is the big one. That's like 95% of them. When I was a kid, when people would try and tease me, they'd say something like, I'm going to slaughter you in a fight or something like that. I didn't necessarily surround myself with the smartest people as a child, but I was 8, so, you know, whatever. Slaughter, I guess, was another one, because it took until high school to realize that my last name was just Laughter with an S before it. Those would be the only two that I can think of.
I'm thinking in back of my mind, and it's like the only baseball player I can really remember at this point in my life was a catcher for the Pirates named Don Slott.
Oh, there was an Enos Slaughter who played baseball. And then there was, I think, a football player with the last name Slaughter as well. Webster Slaughter, I think, was his name. He was on, like, the Oilers when the Oilers existed as a football team.
It's a powerful name. I could see it being a really good brand.
I'm hoping. I've joked around with friends about getting t-shirts. You know those Che Guevara t-shirts where they have his face on it? Just doing that, because, you know, why not culturally appropriate someone? Sidebar. Said in jest, let's move on. Next question.
I could see, okay, you can go with maybe like Andre the Giant has a posse. You could have, you know, instead of Obey, Slot.
There we go. I like it.
Let's talk a minute. One of the you were mentioning a moment ago, the reporting and such. What were you reporting on? Was it sports, local news?
I was the sole reporter, or one of two reporters, really, for two different towns in central New Jersey. So anything that happened, I reported for their weekly free newspaper that the company I worked for did. It'd be the one that shows up on, like, Thursday mornings once a week. All of the stuff was fairly mundane. I mean, I did like a crime beat, so I would talk about the, you know, latest break-ins or whatever. When we didn't have a whole lot of news, which the towns I covered, South Brunswick is out by where Rutgers is in New Jersey, and it's mostly farmlands and not a lot goes on there. It would be like, let's write about the fourth grade class that's doing a science project, and I would have to find 250 words to describe that. Sayreville was the other town, which is a little bigger, a little busier, where Bon Jovi is from, among other people. So I wrote about whatever happened, really.
Small town stuff kind of thing.
Oh, yeah, totally. You know, mayor holding secret meetings about developments and stuff like that. I did get to cover a murder trial, though.
Really?
Yeah, that was interesting. That was in South Brunswick, and the guy was alleged to have killed both his parents and then disposed of their bodies. So that was interesting to be in there and see that. Not on like a show like Forensic Files, but to actually be in the courtroom for it.
I don't really know what I can add to that, really, you know, because I'm not going to, you know, grill you on like what were the details of the case. We're all curious.
Well, the one thing that sticks with me was the lead prosecutor, because he choked both his parents to death, and the lead prosecutor like stood there for a literal minute, like watching the clock, just in complete silence. And then he turned to address the audience, or the jury, or whoever, and said that to strangle someone to death, it takes usually 4 minutes, and that was just 1 minute. Basically, how can you say that it was not premeditated even after, like, the first minute, because there would be 3 more minutes of this? So, yeah, that's always stuck with me. It's one of those fun little facts you can pull out at a party, how long it takes to strangle someone to death.
Yeah, you gotta have a little bit of those. You never know.
Few in the repertoire.
You never know when you're going to need to bust out, you know. Did you know it takes 4 minutes to strangle a person completely to death? Unless you're doing it on the gallows, in which case there's a 50-50 chance they'll break their neck on the way down.
Yeah, that's what I think part of that hangman's noose is for, is to break their neck so that they don't hang there and suffer something.
Well, let's move away from the grizzly for a moment here. You were born in Jersey, right?
Correct. About 20 minutes outside of New York City, a town named Bloomfield.
So, North New Jersey. Is there really a difference between North and South Jersey?
Yes. Yes, there is. South of the Raritan River turns more into, like, backwoods country folk than North Jersey, where I'm from, is the kind of industrial whatever you envision when you think of New Jersey. I mean, my town itself, I grew up on a street with trees. I had a yard and a pool, and, like, I lived in pure suburbia, but you go 10 minutes any direction, and you see the smokestacks, and obviously the turnpike is close enough, and I live right near the Garden State Parkway, so all of those roads that people complain about all the time. But South Jersey, especially the interior of it, is the Pine Barrens, it's swamps, it's cypress stands, it's, you know, where the legendary New Jersey Devil was born and haunts. It's a lot closer to some things that I've seen in the South than it is North Jersey.
Having lived in the South for a while now, do you prefer South Jersey or North Jersey now?
When I go home, I like being in North Jersey because I'm home for a few days, and so it's nice to see those things again, to be able to go and, you know, hop the train into the city. But it's also nice to get away after a few days.
Did you go to the city a lot?
As a child?
No, just growing up, yeah. Was the city a major part in your life?
Often enough. I mean, my high school was right across the river in Jersey City, so if I wanted to, like, I could take the PATH train in right after school, and sometimes I did, to go to concerts, or if we had events for Boy Scouts and other school trips, a lot of the time it was to museums in New York City, so like the American Museum of Natural History, or the Met, or, you know, all of these major museums. Those were our field trips. So went in often enough, obviously, also to see shows, plays, all that kind of stuff. And then once I got to high school, my parents trusted me enough to go in by myself.
And so then you go off, you said you went to college first in New Jersey?
I went to Elon in North Carolina for my undergrad.
Okay, and that's where you started out in anthropology?
Yes. Yep, I was a double major.
What made you interested in anthropology?
I don't know. I was told that I would like the 101 class, and I needed classes, so I took it, and I enjoyed the professor. She is still a major influence on things that I do. But I liked her, I liked the material we were covering, and just kind of stuck with it from there.
I got to backtrack now a little bit here.
Okay.
How did you go from Jersey to North Carolina? Was there, in other words, did you have an inkling in your mind, like, I've got to go to the Southland?
I wanted to get the hell out of Jersey is what it was. I looked at colleges, so like my junior and senior year of high school, my dad and I would take weekend trips, or there was one week that we took to head south, and so like, we would spend a weekend, and I looked at colleges in, like, Boston and Connecticut, because I like Boston as a city, and so I figured I might as well look at some of the schools up there. Looked at Fairfield was the one in Connecticut. And then I had heard about Elon just from a friend who I guess had gone to visit or something, and I was like, whatever, I need to look for schools to go to. And so we planned a trip down to North Carolina, and we went to NC State, and we saw part of Wake Forest, and we saw Elon, and just when I got to Elon, I walked onto the campus and was like, this is beautiful, I'm going to apply here first. And so I applied there, and I got in, and I didn't apply anywhere else.
So it sounds almost like it was love at first sight going to North Carolina.
Yeah, pretty much. I really liked it down there, and I love the state as a whole. The more I've explored it, the more I fall in love with it.
Is that part of the reason you went to USC now?
I mean, it was great to be able to be back in the Carolinas in general. My mentor at Stetson went to the University of South Carolina, so I applied to the program because I respect his work, and from his own talks about the university, I applied. It was also close to some other people, some other things that I was considering, so when I got in and got funding, it was a good day.
So how does one shift, to continue the narrative here, how does one shift from North Carolina, to Montana? Because that's another, you know, extreme shift in geography, location, and lifestyle.
Yeah, and this gets at that whole adventurous spirit thing. I almost went to Thailand instead to teach English. I had been accepted into a program. I didn't know what I was doing with my life, and so that's why I applied to that program, and I thought Thailand would be cool. A few weeks before I had to officially, like, accept and send in documentation and all that stuff, I think it was terrorists, not captured, but surrounded the king in the city that I was going to be in. And so that didn't seem like the best idea. And so I had also been applying to grad schools. I got into a couple, and Montana was one of the ones that I got into. And I figured, well, I've never been there before. Looks cool. Let's try it.
What did you think of Montana?
I love it out there. Right place, wrong time. Missoula itself is a really cool little city. Very artistic, very alive, good beer, good people.
Well, you say right place, wrong time. What do you mean?
I was burnt out from school, and so I wasn't ready to be back in the the grad school mindset. I needed to do some growing up first.
And then you come down to Florida again, another shift.
Yeah, I was applying to jobs for post city year. Wasn't hearing from anything, and so they do. City year has a number of partner schools where they offer scholarships. Stetson was one of them, and so I had applied there and I got in. So I went because I wasn't hearing from the jobs I was here wanted to hear from.
You know, I'm stuck in South Florida. What was your thought on what was your thinking in Florida? Because where you were in the Orlando area, I'm guessing then.
I was an hour north of Orlando, yeah. It is something, that's for sure. The town itself that Stetson itself is known outside of being a university primarily for being where they taped The Waterboy. And then the town itself is just like very super typical small town where a lot of the people stay there and have a very strong passion for said town and they're comfortable there.
Florida is what Florida is.
Yeah, pretty much. One of my favorite places was in New Smyrna Beach. It's a tiki bar that's right on the beach. The drinks were dirt cheap, and the people watching was some of the best I've had in Florida because it was part hotel, but part just dirt cheap tiki bar. And so there would be families with like children running around randomly or just a colorful cast of characters. It was always a good time going there. That, and you could drink, you know, three or four drinks, just be in a good place and go pass out on the beach for a little bit.
That does sound like paradise.
Yeah, it was great.
Do you do a lot of people watching?
I think as a writer, I have to, or maybe not have to, but that is what I do. And I think a lot of, I don't know if I should be generalizing, but I think, well, no, I will generalize because there's precedent. Henry James or Flannery O'Connor or one of those writers talks about the need to people watch as a writer because that's who we're writing about. It's who we're engaging with. If we can't accurately describe the stuff around us or sort of make judgments about what's going on in our world, then we're not going to be good writers. And that's not the quote, but I'm freestyling here. I'm making it up. I promise they said something related to people watching being important. That much is true. Everything else is probably fiction.
When you're doing that, you know, I've done it myself too as a writer and just as an observer. Do you find yourself making up backstories for people?
It depends. Sometimes, if I'm sitting in a bar by myself, probably just to keep myself occupied. It depends on what else is going on around me, I guess. Like I said, if I'm in a bar and if I'm in a static position, probably because I'll need something to do. But if I'm just wandering around, maybe not.
Are you also listening in on people's conversations, looking totally. For a good line or?
Yeah, all the time, you know, with friends, strangers, whoever it is, if they say something or if I hear something that I think would constitute a good line, I do my best to remember it. Or if I'm being smart about it, I'll write it down or something like that.
So let's talk about tiki bars. Let's stop dancing around it. So you are known for your writings about alcohol and booze and spirits.
Apparently, yes.
When does this all begin for you? This love of exploring the massive palette of alcohol that's out there.
So I don't know how or where. Well, in my mind, there are two distinct tracks that this conversation. Okay, let me back up. When I was a kid, I was into like fantasy Dungeons and Dragons and stuff like that. And for some reason, I don't know why, but all of my characters were always the bartender, like at the friendly neighborhood tavern. And I don't know why, but it appealed to me to be that sort of, not center of attention, but as a character, having someone who sort of was the gateway between worlds, if you want to put it like that. So there's that. But my parents went to a lot of wineries when I was a kid. And so I went to a lot of wineries and just kind of stood there awkwardly, you know, like walking in small circles around the gift shop while they did a tasting. But those are the two kind of, I guess, historical points about alcohol for me. I don't know. I've always been interested in it, and I think it's tied to my interest in food. And it was an outgrowth of that. Once I learned about alcohol, it was just another avenue to explore. And when I was in college, my roommate and I got one of those Mr. Beer kits and attempted to make beer, and it was terrible. We drank it, but it was just absolutely terrible. And then I was able to intern in a winery when I lived in Montana. So that was the start of like the official not being an idiot about what I'm doing phase of alcohol education.
You're regularly doing distillery tours and such and blog about them.
Yeah, I'm a spirits writer for the online magazine, The Manual. So I write about alcohol weekly. And whenever I'm in a new place, I like to check out the breweries, the wineries, the distilleries that are in the area just to see what they're doing and, you know, make connections, see the people that are making liquid art, have that kind of dialogue with them about why they do what they do.
You say liquid art.
Booze and food and cooking are all art, you know, baking, you know, maybe more close to math or science, but I'm firmly in the camp that being able to craft, not just a, like crafting a cocktail, but making a high quality spirit or beer or wine, the passion and knowledge that goes into that is the same as it would be for writing a story or a poem or making a movie or anything like that.
Can you tell from just walking into a distillery if they've got that passion or not?
Sometimes. One of my favorite things to do when I go to wineries and stuff is to talk, if we get lucky enough to talk with the proprietors, so the people that are making it, as well as the ones, if they're doing the making of it, giving you the tour and pouring you the taste, I like when that happens because you can really get a sense of what their passion is for it and what it's about. One of my favorite places in Colombia where I live is Crouch Distilling. They're a distillery, obviously, that makes whiskey, and it's a husband and wife, and they are amazing. I love going in there. I've been in there multiple times, and you know, his tour, Philip's tour, is great for everyone. You don't have to know anything about the whiskey making process to go in and come out with an understanding of it, and it shows their passion, and being able to talk through things while they're pouring it and just kind of have a conversation is great. And I think that's where that kind of comes through.
For listeners who are not aware of it, you know, who might be aware, say, of a wine tour and such, how is going to a distillery different than, say, a wine tour? Or is it similar?
Going on a tour of an alcohol-making facility, they vary somewhat depending on the size and stuff like that, but you're going to be seeing a lot of large metal tanks usually. You'll get an understanding of the process to varying degrees, and then you will taste the fruits of their labor. Yeah, they're all similar, but they can vary depending on who is giving the tour and all that good stuff.
So Crouch Distillery is a good bet, in your opinion, to go to if you're in the Colombia area.
Yeah, and what's great is right next door there is one of Colombia's breweries as well. So you can hit two without moving your car. And there's usually a food truck there too. So, you know, get some food and do all that good stuff.
What makes for a good whiskey, in your opinion?
That's a tough question. I think it depends on what your palate is like. So, obviously, you know, whiskey's going to have certain characteristics. They might taste a little bit of corn. There would be that sweetness that's there. Some of them taste more of oak or of char because of the aging process, depending on how long they're aged. And so all of these factors kind of contribute to how you as a drinker will interpret the liquid. And just like with a book or with food or ice cream or anything like that, what I like and what you like may be completely different just because of how our palates are. Another way I think of that is like if you're drinking craft beer, some people really like IPAs, which are bitter and hoppy and sometimes floral or citrusy. It's an acquired taste if you're not used to it, but you know, some people may just not like that at all. So it's just not for them. It doesn't mean it's not a good whiskey or a good IPA. It's just that we all have different taste buds.
Is that the same for all types of alcohol across the board? It all comes down to what your palate is?
I mean, you can definitely cultivate a palate over time. You know, the more you have of something and the more different varieties you have of something, you're obviously going to start to understand the intricacies of whatever, having worked in a brewery and been to enough breweries. I'm not great at it, but like I can pick out certain hop varieties now when I taste a beer. People who are really good at it, really good brewers, really good beer bartenders can do it like that. And so their palate has been cultivated to that point. But a lot of it does relate to your own palate.
What makes for a bad alcohol, though? Because that I don't think... I think that that would be also a universal thing, almost. Not necessarily palate, but what makes for, like, you taste it instantly and go, this is bad.
There are certain off flavors that happen when something has been spoiled. So obviously with a wine, it's going to taste like vinegar. It'll have that sort of sharp taste. So you can guess. Or with some white wines, if they've gone bad, they're going to taste really heavily of cheese. Or at least that's how my own taste buds interpret it. Like when a Chardonnay has gone bad, it'll taste like I'm biting into a block of like cheddar cheese or some other sort of cheese. With beers, there are also certain markers that you can look for. I mean, when you sip it and it tastes, if the first word that comes to your mind is off, like this tastes off, most likely it's going to be bad. And, you know, with cheap liquors, they're going to burn, feel hot. They just won't go down well.
So it's a matter of trusting your instincts sometimes. If you take a sip of something, you're like, no.
Yeah, definitely.
I may sound like I'm asking base questions in a way.
No, I'm making up science as I go along. So hopefully no actual professional spirits people are listening to this, because I probably sound like I'm full of crap.
But to the untrained ear, you sound like a wise man.
It's all about illusion.
How does one become a bit of an expert at this? Is it simply just, you know, drinking a lot?
That obviously that has a part to do with it, but it's drinking a lot in an informed manner. So, you know, I'm in an MFA program where I'm reading, but I'm also reading articles online about, you know, trends or whatever's going on in the spirits industry. I'm reading histories of books about alcohol, reading cocktail manuals and sort of the different books that are being made by the people that are defining the industry now, because there's some fantastic things happening. And it's when you're actually drinking something, going about it again, like in an informed manner. So if you're drinking a bourbon, understanding maybe, you know, the tasting notes that come with it, or looking up for other tasting notes and trying to pinpoint certain things. Again, being that taste is, you know, a person-to-person kind of matter, some of it may not happen. Like a lot of times with wines, people will say that they taste leather or other really weird things like that. And some people may not. It depends.
So it's not just going down to the liquor store, buying a bunch of bottles and just drinking them. You have to drink them, but also really think about it. Yeah. And do some work.
Yeah. When I get new spirits in the mail from companies that I haven't had before and that I have to, that I'll be using in pieces, I'll usually get a friend to come over or a couple of friends, whoever's around, to taste some stuff so that I can taste it and talk through it with them. And usually it's just, it's us drinking, you know, sipping a shot of it or whatever, but getting them to say their ideas while I just kind of talk out loud about what I'm thinking about it and see if they're registering the same things as I am, or if they're not, what are they getting out of it, and kind of trying to find some sort of common ground so that I have a better understanding of multiple people's takes on it.
Sounds almost like a writing workshop.
Sort of, yeah.
But instead of a poem, you're workshopping a shot of whiskey.
Yes, I like that idea.
Well, you mentioned you're keeping up with trends and such, and I'm thinking then, yeah, obviously as a journalist, as a blogger, you have to. What trends, I mean, here we are, it's only early January right now, but what are some of the trends you're seeing that have been going on maybe the last quarter of 2015 and now going into 2016? What are some of the trends you're talking about and seeing that are happening right now in the spirits world?
I mean, obviously any winter time, there's going to be a push on the hot cocktails. So hot toddies, National Hot Toddy Day was January 11th, I believe. And that's a push by who knows who to, you know, bring light to the hot toddy. Which has a fairly storied history dating back to 1500 or 1600, something like that. But there's been a nice push on, obviously, small batch spirits are a big thing. Craft distilling, just like craft beer, is a big thing. Also, certain organizations have been doing really good work looking at spirits that we don't see every day. So stuff that maybe isn't normally available or is available, but we just don't know it's there in the United States. So something like Pisco, which is a South American thing. Soju is a Korean spirit, bringing light to things like that and incorporating them into cocktails and bar menus and stuff like that.
Are there any trends that you want to see eliminated? You would not cry if they disappeared.
Fireball? Beyond Fireball. I don't know. I think most of the things that I find annoying, none of them are really coming to mind, but they all just tend to go the way of the wind anyway. And there's so much happening anyway that there's always going to be new things to try to forget about whatever may not be the best. And in order to find the really good stuff, you also have to try the bad stuff. So, whatever.
Are there any trends that you're really excited to see happen? You mentioned things like incorporating more global spirits into it. Are there any trends that you're excited to see take off?
I had a chat with, who was it? I believe it was the owner of Death & Company, which is a bar in New York City, one of the highest rated ones there. I interviewed him, and he talked about the lower alcohol percentage kind of session cocktails. Like, you have session beers that are lower in alcohol, but you can have multiple of them. Like, you wouldn't have multiple double IPAs that are 10 or 11% each, but you'd have a 4% IPA. So you still have that flavor, but you can have a session of drinking them. Some cocktail bars are doing sessionable cocktails so that they're a little lighter. Maybe they're a little sweeter sometimes, depending, but you can have more than one in a sitting and still feel fine. You won't get obliterated.
So you can enjoy more without that worry that you're going to be blasted.
Yeah, and drinking is it's a time to be to gather socially. I think it was Mary Douglas, as an anthropologist, who talked about the drink being sort of the ultimate signifier of an acquaintance or something. Like, you share a meal with a friend, but you can have a drink with an acquaintance, and the drink acts as the, not the barrier, but the bridge between two people. The social aspect of drinking is part of why the anthropology stuff still sticks around, is because it's of interest to me, how we form connections around alcohol. And that's what I try and explore in some of my writing as well. What we do around a bottle or around rounds of drinks or whatever.
A lot of truths in a bottle of whiskey, a lot of lies in an empty one.
Yep.
Stole that from Jimmy Buffett, never forgot it. What about for people who don't drink? Because I've come to know in the last couple of years a lot of writers who don't drink anymore. Can they still be a part of that social dynamic?
Yeah, and that's something that I also deal with, being that, like, I have to write about alcohol. Sometimes I don't necessarily want to go out and have a beer or whatever, but being as we're in an MFA program, that's our coping mechanism a lot of the time, is to go have a drink. And I meet it with mixed success. There are a number of mocktails, I think they're called, out there that you can find, you know, to imbibe. For me, if I'm in a social setting where people are drinking and I don't want to, I have to make a conscious effort to, like, have a club soda. That's my go-to. And as long as I have that in my hand, like, the physical motion of drinking something kind of quells the need to actually have alcohol.
Non-alcoholic beer, perhaps.
Yeah, and again, that's one of the things I think that will come to light more as well, is the more people that are looking at it and experimenting with it, the more stuff we'll have as far as options go. I saw an article a week or so ago about different things you can try in January if you're doing like a month of no drinking or whatever. These are the things to have. So there are people out there that are writing about it and exploring it.
And I'm just always curious because we have the stereotype of writers as, you know, heavy drinkers. So it can be difficult sometimes in a social situation, you know, not be drinking.
Yeah, definitely.
Now, I'm guessing with your knowledge, and everything, have you done bartending before?
Yes. I bartended on and off for a few years now. Craft beer bars, private bartending, stuff like that.
Do you still do it, you know, on the side or whatever?
Not now. I probably will over the summer when I need a job to, you know, pay bills and stuff. But I really like bartending. I like the social aspect of it. I enjoy it. So I don't mind going back to doing that.
You're also known for creating cocktails.
I do create cocktails.
Do you do that as a bartender, or do you have that much freedom?
No. That's really just at home with friends or in social gathering places where I can have some freedom to experiment or whatever. No, not as a bartender. I don't have, I think, the skills to operate at a craft cocktail establishment like that. I would need more time behind a bar before I would feel comfortable doing that and doing it consistently well.
I would think that, yeah, the majority of places with bartenders are like, no, stick to the standards. That's what people want.
Yeah, mostly.
Have you ever surprised yourself with the cocktails that you've made?
Probably. I was working with a vodka company recently to make some cocktails, and we did one with the vodka and champagne and Saint Germain, which is elderflower liqueur, and I believe there was some club soda in there as well. I think that was what it was. And that was very nice. I ended up seeing basically the same recipe about 2 weeks later on a different website, but it was cool to come up with it at the time. I obviously didn't come up with it originally because it's been out there. I just didn't see it, but it was good.
Do people request cocktails from you? I mean, do they request, like, you know, oh, make me want to name it after me or something like that?
No, not yet.
Yeah, okay.
We haven't gotten to the naming of things yet.
You should branch out maybe into that realm.
Just start branding people's names into cocktails.
Yeah. You know, like, here, you know, donate X number of dollars and I will make and design a cocktail for you. Quick way to get slaughtered, you know.
Perfect. I'll just add that to my website as a freelance service.
I'm going to backtrack a little bit off of booze for a moment, because you mentioned that part of this love of booze and getting into it and getting into the spirits world and everything comes out of Dungeons & Dragons.
Very loosely.
But you were a player back in the day.
Sort of. I played the, computer game version, and I did, the online role-playing games.
But you were never the hardcore sitting down with, 12 books around you and a pile of pizzas.
I didn't have enough friends to do that. And we were all sort of dumb, so I don't think we would have been able to figure it out at, 8 or 9. Yes. Our version of Magic the Gathering was, buying the cards and just kind of flipping them over and assuming one of us won. Mine looks more powerful. I win this round.
This number is bigger.
Yes, that was the extent of it. We were very, very serious about it, clearly.
I was just curious as a side topic there, because just, you know, I gotta know as a nerd in me.
I would have been into it. I think, that, obviously, the storytelling aspect of it, plus board game thing, I've never played a round of it, or whatever it would be called, a game.
So let's return to the aspect of bartending and the love of it and such. You mentioned that you enjoy the sociability of it, the interaction, that building connection as the bartender. What are the downsides of it, in your opinion?
You're on your feet a lot. You have to deal with drunk people who don't always want to see eye to eye with you. Those are the two biggest ones. I mean, being on your feet for, 8 or 9 or 10 hours in a row. Obviously, bartending is not the only profession that you do that for, but dealing with drunk people can get tiresome depending on how drunk they are and how uppity they feel like being.
Ugh, believe me, I've been there. I was not a bartender, but I was a DJ in a bar.
Yeah. Granted, I've been the drunk person. Not that I fight with bartenders or restaurant people, but I've been the drunk person sitting at a bar before. I think having worked as a bartender and also as a waiter for longer than I've been a bartender, there's an innate sense to not make their day worse because I know what they're going through. So I do my best to just be a good, kind patron and tip them nicely. You have to really do something to screw it up. And it has to definitely be your fault if I'm not going to give you the 20% or more. If the food gets messed up, obviously, 90% of the time that's not on the waiter, so there's no reason to yell at them for it. Just let them know, and that's about it.
And usually it's taken care of if you're polite about it.
Yeah, and if I'm going out to a restaurant, and if I'm at, a diner, and I get some sort of cheeseburger instead of a sandwich or something, half the time I don't care. I don't want to mess with anything in the back kitchen. I don't know how vindictive the chefs are being or the line cooks or anything like that. And so I just go with it. Whatever. That meal is then what I should have had instead. I should have ordered it to begin with.
Let fate deal with it, you know?
Yeah, it's only calories and stuff.
Reminds me of one of the best pieces of advice I ever heard, although I was never a waiter myself. You know, I'd worked in the food service industry as third shift dishwasher at a Denny's.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the best pieces of advice I ever heard, though, is if you are ever in a restaurant and you're not getting great service and you can see and the waiter's like, I'm so sorry. You know, one of the best things I learned to say is just, don't worry. It's all good. I've been there myself. I was a waiter once.
Yeah, I think being a waiter or a busboy or a host or anything in the service industry should be a requirement at some point so that you as a person, when you grow up, are less of a dick to people when you're in restaurants. Like I've been out to dinner with people before and it makes me cringe when they like either snap at a waitress or like just call them over like they're, you know, boy, come over here. Or don't say please or thank you or things like that. It just, it hurts me on the inside because I've been in that position where I've been called boy or, you know, just ordered around like I am the not worthy of the dirt on their shoes or something.
So don't be a dick.
Pretty much. That's what it boils down to. Don't be a dick and remember that you're probably helping them pay for like a bill or something that they have. Tip nicely.
You know, you don't want to be remembered at the end of the night in a way.
Yeah, you don't want to be the one that we go home and talk about. Also, when you make friends with a bartender, you know, if it's not busy, that may be to your benefit. You may end up, you know, getting a little bit extra in your drink than you thought. Or, you know, they may look the other way on, you know, putting a beer onto your tab or something. Like, being nice can have its benefits. And then that also, you know, can benefit your tip later on.
There's nothing like becoming on first name basis with a restaurant in the good way.
Yeah, being friendly with them and, you know, having your favorite seat at the bar or whatever and having your favorite waitress or waiter or whatever.
Same goes, I think, for retail. The advice of don't be a dick.
Yeah, if you've ever had to have a job where you're interacting with people who can get angry at you for no reason, I think you very quickly understand that you should not do the same thing when you are in that position.
I think you're right. Everyone needs to have at least one retail and one food service job in their lifetime.
Yeah, and the sooner the better. I mean, I didn't start till I didn't have my first food service job till I was 18, actually. But from that point on, I mean, I've been in and out of it at various restaurants, and I've had great experiences, and I've had really bad ones. And they've all sort of shaped how I approach restaurants. Like, again, you have to really, really mess things up, and it has to be on you as the wait staff for me to not give you the 20% plus. Like, you really need to piss me off to not get that.
You basically need to physically attack me.
Short of that, yeah. Just short of that, and
I don't want to imagine, though. My brain is immediately trying to think of what would piss me off enough that I would be like, all right, no tip for you.
One of the things that, so, like, if the restaurant is close to dead and the service takes forever and, like, I can see you as a waiter just kind of standing there, like, on your phone or talking to other people when I'm waiting on, like, coffee or another refill or something like that, and it gets to the point where it's been, you know, 20 minutes, 30 minutes, whatever it is, then I'm just sitting there seething because I can see you and you're not doing anything. Something like that. But again, the fuse on that is very long.
I'm going to inquire, you know, having been on the other side of the bar, so to speak, what advice could you give people on how to be better to bartenders?
Waving money in a bartender's face is not a thing to do. Keeping your drinks simple. Like, if you're at a bar that's serving, you know, has a liquor bar, but beer and wine, like, and it's a Friday night at 10 o'clock, don't go asking for a cocktail that has 9 different ingredients in it and then get pissy when it takes, like, 10 minutes to get to it, because in that time we could have opened, you know, 12 beers and poured 4 glasses of wine and made, you know, many more people happy. So keep it simple. If it's very busy, don't just shout at them and be like, hey, 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 I'm over here. Crap like that's annoying, I think, to anyone. Again, it comes back to just don't be a dick.
So the bartender can see you, and they know you're there. You don't need to keep waving money at them.
Yeah, and if it's super busy and you're trying to, like, push people out of the way to get your drink, there's a chance that we may ignore you further. Like, at a certain point, there is that kind of childish glee of, like, now I'm just going to make you even angrier. I know I'm not going to get a tip from you, but this gives me joy.
Oh, man, you're speaking my language there as a former bar DJ. Having the headphones on was a magical experience sometimes because it meant I could ignore someone.
Yep.
Can you play this? Can you play this? And you just hold up one finger like, what? And then you act like you're moving some dials around.
Like, yeah.
I'm doing the mix right now. Shut up. Have this. Then the fun, I can tell you one of the fun things I had was when somebody would come up and be like, can you play this song? And I think, yeah, I'll play it in like 15 minutes or so. They come back and they're like, you didn't play my song. I'm like, you must have been in the bathroom, man. We hit it.
One of the things that I think of, wait, am I allowed to use profane language?
Oh, fuck yes.
Okay. One of the things that I think of is from Fight Club, actually. One of the rules that they talk about for Project Mayhem or whatever it is don't fuck with the people who handle your food. Same thing goes for your drinks. Like, just, again, don't be a dick. Comes back to that every time.
Just be cool. Be cool. Yeah. Smile. Be polite. Keep it simple.
And then when you're going there for a fancy 9-ingredient cocktail, you expect that it's going to take a little while because there is craft and artistry that's going into it. So sit down and wait your damn turn.
But hopefully some of our listeners will take this to heart.
Or I'll get hate mail somewhere for some reason.
You'll get hate mail for it.
It'll be my first time, so maybe, you know, if someone wants to send some hate mail, you can be my first. Just putting that out there, world.
I'm always curious to know people's nemeses, but let's not get into that. That's in writing. Let's not even talk about that on the show.
I would love to have one, so if someone wants to apply, I will consider their application enthusiastically.
What can you offer me as a nemesis? Okay, you can give me some hateful Twitter comments. Well, that comes dime a dozen these days.
Yeah, that's too easy. You need to take it to another level. Short of, like, stalking and physical violence, what can you deliver for me as a literary nemesis?
Well, I can stab a pumpkin with a butcher knife and put it on your doorstep with the note "you" on it.
As long as I get to keep the knife, because, I mean, good knives are hard to find, just like men.
Good chef's knife, man. Number one thing you need in the kitchen, according to Bourdain.
There you go.
I actually do want to touch on writing now before we wrap this all up, because this hour has flown by.
Yes, it has.
It has flown by on us, and I know there is more we could talk about. But before we wrap up, let's talk about your literary work and what you got coming out and what you got coming down the pike, etc. So you are the author of one chapbook.
Yes, I am. When You Cross That Line. It is five short stories that you can read in the span of one subway ride, one trip to the bathroom, I don't know, 20 minutes or so and you're good. You get all five stories.
And they're all about Florida Man.
They're based on Florida Man headlines, yes. Each one is taken and changed from a Florida Man headline.
Indeed, and if you don't know what Florida Man is, look it up on the net. You know what we're talking about, folks. And then you've got Lucky Bastard Press coming out with your next piece next year, I believe. Or this year, is it?
This year, yeah. My first full-length collection of short stories, God in Neon, is coming out. I'm really excited for that. Indeed. It's got two sections. The first section are linked stories, and then the second section are some other stories.
Well, we'll be looking forward to it. Any idea when that drops? Like in the fall, spring, summer?
Hopefully soon. In the next couple of months, I think.
Well, we'll keep our listeners informed, though, when it drops, because it is, I guarantee it's probably going to be good.
I'm happy with it.
And you mentioned it right at the top of the program, you're working with SAFTA now in some way.
Yes.
Kind of, sort of,
yeah. I did a cocktail workshop back in September on the day of the lamb slaughter, actually. It was a very, very packed day. Lamb, cocktails, blood, all that sort of stuff. It was super fun. We made some cocktails, some literary-based cocktails. So we looked at some of the sort of signature drinks for some writers. And what we would do is we would make it, we would talk about it a little bit, and then there would be time for writing. And over the course of the 2-3 hours, whatever it was, we made more cocktails. And we reflected in our writing on how the alcohol affects one's writing. And then we would talk about it and share and all that good stuff. I had a lot of fun. I hope to do it again. And I think the people there had a lot of fun.
You have a reading at what's after coming up, right?
Yes, at the beginning of February, February 7th, with Kristen Gibson. I am really sorry if I got her name wrong. I think it's Kristen Gibson, though.
February 7th in the Knoxville area. Definitely come check it out. Sam, it is a pleasure having you on the program, man.
It's been fun.
Talking about booze and many, many more things.
Like murder and nemesis.
Yeah, murder and nemesis.
Have fun tagging this one.
Oh, I've already got a few ideas of what I could put down there. But anyway, enjoy your time in the SAFTA world and everything, and looking forward to hearing more from you in the near future.
Sounds good. We'll do this again sometime.
I hope so.
Thanks for having me on here.
Come back on anytime, man. We'll love to have you back. Take care, man.
You too.
The SAFTAcast is a production of the Sundress Academy for the Arts. For episodes and more, visit SAFTAcast.com. Until we talk again, this is your host, Scott C., signing off.